Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this month's edition of Headliners. I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's, a particular pleasure for me tonight to welcome my colleague Brian Atwood to our forum this evening. Many people who've been through presidential transitions in the past acknowledge that the combination of two wars abroad, an economic meltdown at home, and unparalleled security threats worldwide make this perhaps one of the most challenging and important transition periods in modern history. Last week, President-elect, don't rush things too much, right? Well, some of you, I hear the applause. President-elect Obama announced the economic team he selected to help him address the current crisis and a $1.5 trillion budget deficit he's inheriting. This week, he announced his foreign policy and national security teams. These appointments are drawing greater scrutiny than ever before, perhaps. Well, fortunately for us, Brian Atwood is one of the people who've been through a presidential transition in the past. Tonight, he'll provide firsthand perspective on the transition process and share his thoughts on how the incoming administration should invest its political and financial capital. Brian was named Dean of the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs in 2002, building on a long and distinguished career in public service. He led the Clinton administration's transition team at the State Department and served 6 years as head of the U.S. Agency for International Development. We hear it as USAID. In 2001, he served on U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan's panel on peace operations and was the only American on a 10-member panel which recommended major changes in the United Nations peacekeeping and peacebuilding operations. His work promoting human rights and democratic values around the world has been recognized with the Secretary of State's Distinguished Service Award and an honorary doctorate from American University. Earlier this month, Dean Atwood joined a bipartisan coalition of foreign policy leaders urging President-elect Obama's transition team to ensure that strong international development and diplomacy are key components of his foreign policy and national security strategy. Will you please join me tonight in welcoming Dean Brian Atwood.
Well, thank you very, very much. It's a wonderful crowd here on a cold weekday night. I'm very impressed at your thirst for knowledge, and I hope I can convey some at least. And I want to thank Dean Mary Nichols and her College of Continuing Education. And in many ways, this is what the university is all about. We're a land-grant university. We really believe in what is called by academics engaged scholarship. And we want to engage the community, and this college is the college that does it so well. And look, I know you didn't come for the food. I've had a little bit. It was fine, but Mary does a great job, and Margie Ligon as well. And I've had the great pleasure of participating in one of the conversations that are run by this college as well. And they also bring people from around the world, and it's great. Let me assure you that you're not going to get too much scholarship tonight. You're going to get a lot of personal memories, and I hope that they are relevant, because I think that there may be hidden in some of these anecdotes some lessons for all of us as we look at the transition that is going on now. I'm going into Washington next week, and we'll be meeting with the State Department and USAID transition teams. And I'm sure that if I were to give this lecture, whatever it's called, a week from now, I probably would have more insights than I do now. But I'm mainly going to talk to you about my experiences in presidential transitions. And let me start, if I can make the machine work here, with a little bit of history. I'm not going to belabor this, but I do think it's important for us to understand the way presidential transitions have evolved over the years. Some of you undoubtedly know that it was the 20th Amendment to the Constitution that for the first time set the date of the inauguration as January 20. prior to that, it was March, so a full 4 months after the presidential election. I think all of you see, as this transition is going on now, that it's a fairly awkward period because the president-elect doesn't have any power, has a lot of influence. Obviously, people are hanging on every word, but he can't take action. And I think as I go through my presentation tonight, you'll see some of the implications of that, and especially, as Mary indicated, we're in a period now when there are a couple of wars going on and a major financial crisis is with us already. There was an article by the biographer of Herbert Hoover in the New York Times the other day, William Lichtenberg, who talked about the period in 1932, which was the period when the presidential transition still went on for 4 months. And he mentioned that there was, at the time, of course, we were in the midst of the Depression. It was a run on banks, a lot of things that sound quite familiar to us today. And yet the awkward part was that Hoover was really hanging on to his policies. He believed strongly in the gold standard. He really wanted to convince FDR during that transition period that this was the right approach and that this was the only approach. And it was an awkward period because he continued to try to convince FDR, and FDR just tried to remain aloof because he had no power. And he was at the time trying to put his own transition together and to try to figure out what he wanted to do when he came to power. Now, the presidential transition system was changed fairly dramatically in 1963 with the adoption of the Presidential Transition Act, which authorized for the first time federal funding for the transition. And I think you all understand that this is a period when a new president, a newly elected president, is trying to prepare to take over one of the most complex operations in the world. Prior to 1963, the political parties paid for these expenses. And that was a little awkward, since the political parties had spent most of their money trying to get the person elected in the first place and didn't have a lot of money to pay for transitions. Now, President Kennedy's transition, which occurred, of course, prior to 1963, cost $360,000. But Kennedy's transition was probably the first in the modern era that was very sophisticated. He had teams of academics and other intellectuals that he actually started meeting even before his election. So he was pretty well prepared and, of course, brought in a lot of sophisticated people into government. But that cost was only $360,000. Now, this year, the cost will exceed $8 million. Now the dollar isn't the same value as it was back then, but still, the General Services Administration administers this. In other words, they provide the facilities, they provide the support, and of course, in this case, we have a transition office both in Washington, D.C., and a transition office in Chicago, where the president-elect is residing for the time being. Every single government agency receives a transition team that comes in and sort of is given a suite of offices, and you kind of take over. And I'll give you a bit of experience, my own experience. I was asked, after having been out in the wilderness for some period of time, in fact, let's see if the next slide is the right slide that comes up here. No, I've got them out of order just a bit, so let me go forward to the next one. 12 years, the people that had served in the Carter administration were kind of out there doing various things. I ran something called the National Democratic Institute, so I was very much engaged with the international community. And so when the position came open, when we won the election, I'm in a nonpartisan position now, so I have to be very careful about how I put this tonight. I clearly served in Democratic administrations, but I had been a career Foreign Service officer, and so part of the rationale, I guess, for selecting me was that I knew something about the State Department, and I knew something about the international community because I had remained engaged. And so happened that the chairman of the board of the National Democratic Institute during my tenure was a person by the name of Walter F. Mondale. And so I went in and formed a team. We had about 8 people on the team. I selected a career officer by the name of George Moose to be my deputy. And the concept was that we had to basically look at all of the policies in place and come up with a briefing book for the Secretary of State designate. Obviously, this is a period when everyone is looking for a job. And that includes the career people at the State Department. They're coming down to you and knocking on your door and saying things like, you know, I served in the last administration, the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, but I'm really a Democrat. And, you know, I lost respect for them for saying that because I've always believed very strongly the Foreign Service is the balance wheel of our foreign policy, that the Foreign Service has to serve presidents of both parties and has to be highly professional in the way they go about their business and has to be as objective as they possibly can about their recommendations that they give to the political appointees that come in. So there were some people that I recommend be retained, including one political appointee that became very important in the Clinton years. His name was Dennis Ross, and he was the chief negotiator on the Middle East. I was very impressed with him. He served very loyally in the Bush administration, but of course told me that he also campaigned for George McGovern. So that's not what convinced me. What convinced me was his knowledge base and what he knew about the Middle East and, of course, the very delicate negotiations between Israel and Palestine. Perhaps one of the most important things I did when I was the transition leader was to call Fritz Mondale out here in Minnesota 2 days before there was a newspaper article saying that President-elect Clinton had asked him to be the ambassador to Russia, to the Soviet Union. And initially the reports were that he had accepted that position, and then all of a sudden he said, no, I'm not going. And one can only imagine the conversation between Fritz and Joan. But the fact is he made a decision not to go to Russia. So I was in the secretary-designate's office, secretary-designate Warren Christopher, speaking to him and his aide, Peter Tarnoff. And they were saying that Japan is an important position. It's always been the ambassador there has been, you know, people like Mike Mansfield, the former majority leader of the Senate, the former Speaker of the House, Tom Foley. Who could we get to go there? And I said, what about Fritz Mondale? Well, he turned down the Soviet Union. I don't think that's going to work. So I went back to my office and called him on the phone and said, what about Japan? And perhaps because of the ceramics industry there, I'm not sure. He said, I'll get back to you. And I said, well, it would be helpful to know today. And he got back to me in a couple of hours and said I'd be happy to go. And I think if I did nothing else in the transition, I did a great favor for our U.S.-Japan relations. There's no question about that. Now, let me just give you a couple of case studies here. Go back one slide and talk a bit about my personal experiences in terms of transitioning out of government. I can only assure you that transitioning out is not as much fun as transitioning in. And the Carter administration was a very sad administration. I don't mean sad in terms of accomplishments. I really believe that there were a tremendous number of accomplishments by the Carter administration, the human rights initiatives, the Panama Canal Treaty, the SALT Treaty, the opening of diplomatic relations to China, You could go through a whole number of things. But it was very, very sad because some of my colleagues at the State Department were being held as hostage for the last 444 days of that administration. And it was a very, very difficult period. I remember I was serving at the time as Assistant Secretary of State for Congressional Relations, a very important job. I was very young at the time, but it's the job where you basically have to go to Congress, explain our foreign policies, try to get their approval for the State Department Authorization Bill, the Foreign Assistance Act, all of those things, and try to prevent them from doing really bad things to our foreign policy. So it's a job where you work very closely with the Secretary of State, and I work very, very closely with Cyrus Vance, who was then the Secretary of State. And the hostage crisis went on, and of course, there was a very well-kept secret, and it really was well-kept, that we were planning to rescue the hostages, although a number of us in positions could surmise that something was going on. I remember the day of the rescue mission being called down to the secretary's office. And there sitting, waiting, as well was the assistant secretary for the Middle East. And lo and behold, he didn't know what was going on, but we both sat there and pieced the puzzle together. And by the time the deputy secretary, Warren Christopher, came back, we had kind of figured out that there was a rescue going on. And then we were told about 10 o'clock at night that the rescue, in fact, had failed, that the helicopters had crashed and we lost some people in the desert of Iran. So we were asked, various of us, some of us were asked to send diplomatic cables around to different people. I was asked to get a list together of the people that Secretary Vance should call and tell them about this disaster. And so I, about midnight, the secretary came back from the White House, and I was all alone with him in his office, and we started making calls. His secretary would place the calls, and we'd wake people up, and he did his duty. He told them that, in fact, the rescue mission had failed. And in between calls, he said to me, "Brian, this has been a really difficult one for me." He said, "I've told the president that I'm resigning over this. I have served at the Defense Department. I know that the military always says that they can get it done, and I believed very strongly that our people, meaning the State Department people that are being held hostage, would be put at risk by this operation." So it was quite a shock to me, and it wasn't until about 5 days later that it was actually announced. And the very next day, all of the top officials of the administration went to Capitol Hill to brief them on what happened. The Secretary of Defense, the Secretary, the CIA Director, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, et cetera. And, of course, the Secretary of State wasn't there. It was the Deputy Secretary for reasons that would be known 5 days later. So that was a very difficult period. And, of course, then Secretary Ed Muskie was named to be a senator who was a presidential candidate earlier, was named to be Secretary of State. We went through the fall, the presidential campaign. There was a great deal of suspicion on the part of the Reagan campaign that there would be an October surprise to follow up on the rescue mission. I believe very strongly, and there are some... There's an excellent book written by Gary Sick. I believe very strongly that there were connections being made by people from the Reagan campaign to the Iranian government. And I think there were agreements reached that the hostages would not be released prior to the November election. I can't prove that, but I think the circumstantial evidence is very, very strong. So I'll just tell you, again, this is in the context of transitioning out. I was in the secretary's office the day before the inauguration of President Reagan, and Deputy Secretary Christopher had been negotiating for the release, and we knew that the agreement had been reached, that we, in essence, would remove the freeze on Iranian money held in American banks in exchange for the hostages. We weren't going to be giving them any money. We were going to simply be allowing them to have their own money back. And we waited all night long in the secretary's office. There must have been four or five of us there. In the morning, the press asked us if they could come up and film us celebrating when we got word that the hostages were released. We waited and we waited. About 11 o'clock, Secretary Muskie called the new secretary-designate, Haig, and asked him if we could use the press room downstairs to explain to the American people that we gave up nothing for the hostages, that we did not give them any money, that in fact we just released their own money. Secretary Haig said, no, you can't use the press room. And I'll never forget standing there 5 minutes before noon and having Secretary Muskie make the quote that you see here. We have to leave. We're going to turn into pumpkins in 5 minutes. And so we all kind of hugged one another, left. I went downstairs, got into my car, drove out of the State Department, and at that moment, President Reagan was giving his speech, his inaugural address. It's dramatic. It's dramatic because that's the way American democracy works. 1 minute you're in power, the next minute you're not. And when you're not in power, and I will go through some of this in a minute, even though you've been elected, you do not have any power, period, under our Constitution. So I then, in the afternoon, I think this is an interesting story, and I sometimes get emotional telling it, because I said before some of my friends had been held hostage, including Bruce Langen, who is from here, from Minnesota. And I got on a plane that afternoon because I had to join a group of people from the State Department down in the South. I flew to Atlanta. And I was sitting in a middle seat because I wasn't important. And all of a sudden, the pilot came on and said, we have confirmation that the hostages have been released. So I sat there with tears coming down my eyes, and everyone thought I was a little crazy. They probably think that tonight as well, but in any case, let me talk a bit about a couple of cases where I think we might be able to draw some lessons. During the time that I was the leader of the State Department transition, President Aristide, the democratically elected president of Haiti, was living in Washington. He had been, of course, the victim of a coup d'etat, and he came into exile here into this country and was living two blocks away from the State Department. And you have to know President Aristide. He was, of course, a priest, and he had a charismatic effect on his people, especially when he spoke his native language, Creole. And so when I say about a world apart, we were kind of talking as very, he's a very intelligent person. He spoke several languages. But we got into a situation where he obviously very badly wanted to meet with a new president, the president-elect. And we wanted him to make a statement to his people to please not get into these rickety boats and try to come to Florida, because several of them were being killed. And there was, of course, in that way, they were being drowned. And there was a cordon of a Navy and Coast Guard ships around Haiti at the time, put there by the Bush administration. And that was a matter that President Clinton, candidate Clinton, had criticized the Bush administration for taking this approach to Haiti. And we then had to decide what we wanted to do. But the first thing we wanted to do was to get President Aristide to make a statement so that they wouldn't just get into these boats. We knew we could see by satellite they were making these boats out of any piece of wood they could find. And so I visited with him, and I said, we would like you to make a statement. And we're going to send over someone from the USIA, the U.S. Information Agency, to interview you so you can make this statement over the radio to your people. It was a big mistake because the person who came over interviewed him in Creole. And when President Aristide speaks in Creole, he speaks in a very different tongue than he does when he's speaking English or French or any other language. And as, in essence, what he did in that interview was to really agitate his people and say, you must throw these people out. And he went on and on and on. And he never made the statement that you shouldn't get into boats. So we were very frustrated about this. And so the next time we went back, we had written a statement for him to read and said that if he really wanted to meet with President-elect Clinton, then he would have to read this statement. And he was kind enough to do it. We had many meetings on Haiti in Little Rock. And one of the purposes was that former Congressman Steve Solars, who was then still a congressman, was asked to put together a plan on Haiti. And the plan that Steve put together on Haiti was basically, we're going to threaten them with military action if they don't yield and allow the democratically elected president to go back. When I heard about his plan, I said to Sandy Berger, who was very close to President Clinton, later became his national security advisor, you know, there is a diplomatic effort underway. Bernie Aronson, who was then working for President Bush, and Jim Baker, who was also happened to be a Democrat, but he was in that administration, the Assistant Secretary for Latin America, is working with both the OAS and the UN, and I believe that, those plans have a possibility of working. And so we went to Little Rock and had this meeting in the governor's mansion, and all sitting around talking about what to do. Vice President Gore was there. Tony Lake, the later became a national security advisor. And Solars gave his plan, and he said, we ought to get Schwarzkopf out there, and we should send them down and threaten them, you know, get the biggest general you can find and go down there and threaten them. I made a point that I think really seemed to reverberate with the president, and that is the president-elect, I should say. And that is, if you start threatening to use the military, the first thing that will happen is that the military will start leaking things out of the Pentagon, saying, in essence, that this young president really doesn't even have a plan, and we can't do this within the first year, and we need to plan, and we need to prepare, and we need to train. And Solars tried to talk over me, and the president-elect said, wait a minute, I want to hear more about what Brian has to say. And as you know, President Clinton didn't start off on the right foot with the military. The gaze in the military issue was a serious one. He was not himself a military officer. He wasn't in the military. And so he was a very, very cautious when it came to that sort of thing. But more importantly, and I guess this is a lesson of the Haiti business, is that we were able to take a plan that had been developed by the Bush administration and to follow it through. And we followed it through to a to its logical conclusion and ran into a stone wall. And then, of course, President Carter, former President Carter, and Colin Powell and Sam Nunn visited on the verge of our actually using military power. And in the end, you know the story, we went in, but we never had any resistance, and the coup leaders left the country. And I had the great privilege of accompanying President Aristide back on JFK's Air Force One. It was no longer the Air Force One, but it was the old 707. And sitting with him in the presidential suite in the front of the plane and saying to him, Mr. President, look down, you'll see your country. It was the first time in several years that he had seen his own country from the air. It was a very emotional moment. So I guess if there's a lesson, exhaust diplomacy first, keep your powder dry, make sure that you have the threat of military power backing you up, but don't just get out there and threaten before you have used the diplomatic route. The next crisis I want to talk about just briefly, I know I'm going on too long here and I'm going to wrap up very shortly, Buzz, but during the transition, I was told by then Secretary of State Larry Eagleburger, who was made a Secretary of State very quickly because as he was actually acting, and President Bush, to do him a favor, basically sent his name up, and he was confirmed by the Senate and actually sworn in while I was there. He was a career person. It was an honor for him, and I had a very good working relationship with him. And he told me that he would tell me everything. There would be no surprises. Well, we've heard a rumor that they were going to send troops into Somalia on a humanitarian mission. So I immediately went up to his office and asked to see him. And the first thing he said when I told him that I'd heard this rumor was, "Damn leaks." You know what happened after. His first comment to me was, "Don't worry about this. We'll be out by January 20." So I said, "Are you going to disarm the people so that we don't have this problem when we come in to office?" "No, we have no intention of disarming anyone. All we're going to do is feed people." I said, "Okay, well, that means 6 months from now we'll have the same problem, I suppose." And he said to me, "Are you trying to tell me that you want us to stay longer?" And I said, "No, I'm not telling you anything. I'm just asking questions." I mean, this gives you a bit of an idea of the delicacy of being in a transition team when you don't have any power and not being really responsible for the decisions that are being made. You can have influence, and I think back, frankly, in retrospect, we should have been a little more forceful about this issue, because Somalia became the real poison pill for the Clinton administration in the first couple of years of the Clinton administration. Secretary of Defense, it's not State, resigned, Les Aspin. There's a typo here. We had the Black Hawk Down crisis. And then the Somalia syndrome, which affected things that we did from that point on. It affected us. We sent a Navy ship down with Seabees mainly into Haiti to try to fortify our embassy and to try to help the Haitians. A mob formed on the docks as the ship came into Port-au-Prince. And in the midst of the mob was the U.S. Chargé d'Affaires, who was a woman, a very accomplished career diplomat, sitting there with a flag on the car and not being harmed. They didn't dare touch the American Chargé d'Affaires. And yet we panicked because of the Somalia syndrome. When we saw the mob, we said, we're not once more going into a country where we don't have adequate force, and so we turned the ship around in full view of the mob. If you want to give a mob a little bit of excitement, then you just turn a ship around in their face. It was horrible. We should have gone in, and nothing would have happened. And then, of course, the worst of all, the Rwanda genocide. And we were frozen in place. We did nothing. When the French decided to go in, I remember one high-level official saying, "Well, we didn't do anything. We have to let the French go in." But the French were clearly taking one side of this issue. So it was a mistake, and I think the whole first 2 years of Clinton's foreign policy was very badly damaged by the Somalia syndrome. And that can happen. And I worry a great deal about what might happen in the next few weeks. We've already had, you know, this terrible disaster in Mumbai, the terrorist action. The president is empowered by the Constitution, hopefully after consultation with Congress, but probably not, to take some action. And it's a very dangerous period, especially if we were to be attacked in some way, as they were in India. So let me talk a bit now about the Obama transition. And as I said before, a lot of what I understand about this transition is because I have friends in Washington I talk to all the time on the telephone, but I also read the newspapers like you. So I don't know that I'm going to be telling you anything you don't know. Let me just start off by saying this transition is the smoothest one I've seen in my lifetime. It is run by a man by the name of John Podesta, who was the chief of staff in the last years of the Clinton White House. He ran a 501c3, a nonprofit, non-governmental organization called the Center for American Progress, that when it was in essence the shadow Democratic government. And a lot of the people that are involved in the transition were working there at that Center for American Progress, including former Senator Tom Daschle. And John has been preparing for this transition for 4 years. And my belief is that if Hillary Clinton had been the nominee, he would have been the head of the transition team as well. It was a 501c3 set up to do a transition. And he's done an absolutely magnificent job. It's highly disciplined. The only leaks you see of the press are leaks that they mean to leak to the press. And what you do in a situation like that is, of course, you are sending names out as a trial balloon to some extent. You've made your choices, but you leak them a little ahead of the official announcement to see what the reaction will be, to see whether or not some of the issues that you know might come up in a confirmation hearing are going to be serious or not. So you allow yourself a little bit of time before you make the official announcement. And so far, so good. He has already selected people that clearly could be called rivals in one way or the other. Hillary is the most prominent, but Joe Biden was selected as his vice president. Bill Richardson just selected yesterday as Commerce Secretary, also a presidential candidate. Obviously, Gates, the Secretary of Defense, wouldn't call him a rival. I think he's a highly professional expert on national security, former CIA director. General Jim Jones, who was as friendly with John McCain as he was with President-elect Obama. Marine Corps Commandant, former NATO commander, and by all accounts, a very, very prominent individual. Now, look what he's done in this case by appointing a general, former general, to be his national security advisor. He has protected himself as Bill Clinton did not in his transition, and I'm talking about an extended transition into his presidency. Do you think that we would have had a gaze in the military issue if Jim Jones had been the national security advisor to Bill Clinton? Tony Lake, who was that and is a friend of mine, he also had no military experience. And so I think that this president-elect has been really clever. The interesting thing about the state transition, based on my experience, is that the leader of the State Department transition is a really important person until the Secretary of State designate is designated. Then all of a sudden, nobody pays any attention to you anymore. Your job is now a staff person. You've got to brief that person, and you've got to worry, as I did, about whether or not I was going to get a job in the new administration. And that's what, frankly, the people in the transition are doing now. All of a sudden, Hillary Clinton is there. She's been told that she can hire her own people. Everyone is worried about, well, what's this going to mean for me? I'll just give you one little story because it affected me. I wanted to be Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs. Secretary-designate Christopher wanted his friend Peter Tarnoff to be the deputy secretary, but the White House had another person they wanted in that position, an African-American by the name of Cliff Wharton. And so Cliff Wharton bounced Tarnoff out of the deputy secretary slot and into the undersecretary for political affairs. I said, I then want to be the undersecretary for global affairs. Tim Wirth, senator from Colorado, wanted to be the interior secretary, but Bruce Babbitt became the secretary of interior, so Tim Wirth got bounced into the undersecretary for global affairs. So I said, okay, I'll take my last choice. I want to be AID administrator. Well, there were two candidates for that. One was Tom Harkin's wife, Ruth, a lawyer, a very prominent lawyer, very good. And the other was a very prominent congressman. I'm sorry I'm blocking on his name, but a good friend of Dave Obey. And Ruth Harkin, I don't think I'm telling stories out of school. She's a good friend. She made a call to Dave Obey, which was probably a big mistake. And she said, "Dave, I know you want your friend to be in this position, but I hope that if I'm chosen that you'll be able to support me." And he said, well, I'm not going to tell you exactly what he said, but it was something that offended her. And she told Hillary, and Hillary said, well, his friend is not going to get this job. And Warren Christopher said, well, Ruth isn't going to get the job either. And I was then called on a weekend. You know, for those of us, the young people in the audience, the lesson here is that luck plays a very big part in your career. So let me tell you just, I'm going to end this very, very shortly because I really am anxious to hear your questions. But this is a period when everyone who has a good idea is trying to get it into the transition team. I feel very fortunate that I was able to convince two of my Republican colleagues who served in the Reagan and Bush W. administrations to join me in writing an article for Foreign Affairs magazine, which is the key journal for people who care about foreign policy, about how to organize our development efforts, our foreign aid efforts. And that article just came out at the end of October. We've made sure that everyone has read it. Betty McCollum sent it to all of her House members, and Senator Menendez sent it to the Senate, and I'm going to Washington next week to give two speeches, one at the Brookings Institution, and we've been asked to meet with the AID transition team, and it's pretty powerful to be able to go there with two Republican colleagues and to basically be on essentially the same wavelength. And that's what's needed if you're going to have reform. And if you're going to have reform, you pretty much have to do it while the president's honeymoon period is still going on. And already we have seen that an idea that Bob Gates and several military officials have testified in favor of is gaining currency. And that is that some of that $600-plus billion defense budget needs to be pushed over to diplomacy and development. It's already being talked about. There's no question there will be very serious reform. Today I read, someone sent me an email with an attachment of the 830-page report of the Project on National Security Reform, which is being put out by the Center for the Study of the Presidency. And that report is signed by any number of very prominent individuals from previous administrations. So everybody times their effort to get into this transition period so that the changes, the restructuring of government, the new ideas, the new resources will be considered by the transition team. I myself had, when I was at State, had several reports that I based our actions on. You can't do it all yourself. So these external reports can be very, very helpful. So I'm very confident that we will be strengthening our civilian national security assets, and hopefully the Congress will go along with that. So we've got several challenges ahead. We need, of course, to implement the withdrawal from Iraq. There will undoubtedly be some a combination of diplomacy and a surge in Afghanistan, augmenting of the forces there because it's very troublesome right now. We've got to deal with the India-Pakistan problem. And I've heard in the Washington Post, you know, one of the things everybody thinks that it's just all word of mouth. The Washington Post is the place if you want to know what's going on, read the Washington Post. They say Dick Holbrooke will be asked to do get involved in the India-Pakistan situation. There were articles recently about the president-elect's phone calls. He's calling half dozen or so international leaders every day and trying to get to know them and them, him. And, of course, we've got this horrible financial crisis. And everyone is trying to define the word stimulus to benefit themselves. And, of course, we've heard the word, the news here, that this state is going to suffer greatly as a result of the deficit that seems impending. So the federal government, by most economists' judgment, needs to begin to print a lot of money and hope that inflation is not the result and that deflation can be avoided and that we can somehow get liquidity back into our economy and credit up. Watch it closely. The plan is that on January 10, the Congress will reconvene and that they will take up a stimulus package that is being worked on right now by Obama's people and will be sent down to the new president the day he's inaugurated and hopefully signed at that moment. Hopefully that will relieve some of the state's burden, but more importantly, it's at least the best chance we have to get some liquidity and a looser credit in our markets. So this president has started off so far very well. The disciplined, highly disciplined transition will lead, hopefully, to a good honeymoon period, and if he can get some things done and gain momentum. However, there are those who would look at the negative, and if you go into a recession, by the summer, it may well be that this president's popularity will be down below 50%, because people will be suffering in this country, and you can bet that Rush Limbaugh will blame Barack Obama. Thank you very much.
Are you able to talk a little bit about the transition from Bush to Clinton and how it affected the wars in the Balkans at the time?
You mean Bush 1 to Clinton, yeah. You know, that situation was not on the front burner when we were during the transition. It sort of evolved, and Milosevic probably started trying to take advantage of the fact that we were in transition to do ethnic cleansing and to, you know, the United Nations was there trying with peacekeeping forces that were not effective because they were there under Chapter 6 rather than Chapter 7, meaning that they had only the right to defend themselves and not very good command and control, which is an issue that we addressed on the Brahimi panel that I served on. So I can remember the Secretary General's representative who gave several orders to just allow these belligerents to continue to occupy parts of Bosnia and other parts of that country, the Serbian part and the Croatian part, and so all three, and the Muslim part, all three ethnic groups were warring with one another. And that became as well a situation. 2 years into the administration, we were still struggling with Bosnia, and we hadn't taken forceful action. And it demonstrated to me that prevention is such an important aspect, that you need to do things to prevent crises from getting to the point where they're unmanageable unless you use military force. And I'll never forget taking to, this is kind of instructive in a way, AID has a satellite system called the Famine Early Warning System, and we had satellite photographs and ground truthing, in other words, checking at the marketplace on food shortages in East Africa. And we estimated that there were 20 million people at risk. And I took this. I used to do a breakfast every month with Vice President Gore, with a few of his people that were interested in environmental matters, and we took this issue to him. And he said, all right, I want you to take this to the president, but let's go talk to Tony Lake and make sure that's okay first. A different vice president than Cheney, I might add. And so we did that, and Tony said, fine, and I went to a meeting of all of the principals. CIA director was there, and the Joint Chiefs, and Secretary of Defense of State, et cetera, and made my case that we should get out in front with a presidential initiative. We should get the other donor countries to provide food so that we could prevent these people from leaving their homes. And the president said, this is exactly right. This is what we need to do. We need to get out ahead of crises. And I'll never forget saying yes, and I think that the Bosnia situation demonstrates that if you don't get out ahead of a crisis, you'll find it unmanageable. And Tony Lake said, that's not true. It was true. And so I led a presidential delegation to East Africa. I went to the Vatican. I went to everywhere of place of a moral authority to try to raise money and food. And we sent food there, and we prevented that major famine from happening that time, and took another initiative to try to get the countries of East Africa to work together, especially sharing food when one country produced an excess of food to sell it to the other countries. And it was a very successful initiative. And I firmly believe, I'll tell you one other, I think it might be an insight, I hope. You know, when you become a professor, you feel as though you can convey insights as opposed to guessing. I went to the White House. I actually wrote an article in the Washington Post, and I said, we have got to create a culture of prevention in the U.S. government. We have the tools to do it. We can prevent some of these crises. The person from the White House said, we can't risk that. If we say publicly that we are an administration that wants to prevent crises, and then one happens, we'll be blamed for not being successful in implementing a policy of prevention. Baloney, you know, sorry, but we've really got to do better, because we can't handle all the crises. The world can't handle all the crises that we're facing today. So now, of course, we have terrorism. We've always had terrorism, but we have it in spades now. Sorry to go on so long. I'll try to answer
the next
one.
I'm not the only one that feels like there's too many crises around enough already, right? We have a question in the back on the left over there.
President-elect Obama is unique in a number of different ways, and I was wondering if you could comment on how that uniqueness, his coming out of nowhere, his being an African American, is affecting the way that he deals with foreign leaders, particularly in East Asia, Africa, and so on.
That is an excellent question, and this is the first president we've ever had who is really, truly a multicultural president. And he's not just an African-American. His mother was of European stock. His stepfather was Indonesian. He lived in Indonesia for 3 or 4 years. He tells stories in his book, The Audacity of Hope, about running around neighborhoods with his Indonesian little boy and girlfriends, stomping around in the mud, going to the little stand where they sold bananas. He has a feel for what it's like to live in poverty. He grew up then in Hawaii, also a multicultural state. He has a feeling for intercultural communication that no other president has had. Not to say that they didn't acquire one, but it was always a question of a president saying, we can have a good communication, but it has to pretty much be on American terms, because that's all I know. And this is the first president that really, he knows Africa, he knows Asia, and he has a feel for intercultural communication. I think we're tremendously advantaged by this, in addition to the fact that he is extremely bright. So I think that's going to serve him well. Now, the other thing that serves him well is the fact that the world would have voted overwhelmingly for him. And You know, I mean, not everybody probably in this room voted for him, but the fact is that 80% of Europeans, 74% in one poll, 80% in another, same in Africa, they were celebrating his victory, Asia. This is a tremendous advantage for the United States. You know, de Tocqueville said that when he came here and examined our country, that there are wonderful aspects of this country, but it's so pluralistic it could never have an effective foreign policy. We're too, you know, too democratic, too many ethnic groups and all of the rest. And yet, over the years, that and our values have stood us well. And now I think you're seeing all of this coming together in one person. I don't want to put too much on his shoulders. He's already got enough on his shoulders, but I think it's going to be successful in that regard.
I have another question back there. Yes, please.
The State Department and the Defense Department seem to always be, or not always, but oftentimes at odds from a policy standpoint as to where they should be going. And now we have 24-hour news and multiple stations where every minute there's a breaking news story, whatever breaking news might be. How do you balance that when you're trying to make policy, when you're constantly being bombarded and questioned for everything that you do?
And one of the games that's played in Washington is if you don't like the policy that has been decided, you leak the other side of the story, so it's inevitable that everything is going to get out eventually. And I have to say this, that this transition has been highly disciplined, tremendous control over what is released to the press. But, you know, once you get into government, there are a lot of other people that have access to information. And it's the people that have half the story that usually leak the stories to the press. And the press in Washington is very sophisticated. They also can add two and two and come up with the right answer on occasion. So it isn't always some sinister person trying to undermine your policy. I've been in meetings with secretaries of state who've just, early morning meetings where they've just read the Washington Post. And they'll come in and bang the table and use expletives and say, who's leaking? We've got to stop this. I'm sorry, but that's just the nature, you know, of government and this democracy. And we've had people in this administration who have believed that they could do things like torture people and put a top secret stamp on it and think they could get away with it, and that the people involved don't feel compelled as Americans to tell the world that that's happening, because it's against our nature to do things like that. So it is difficult. I have to say that Gates and Rice worked really well together. I've served on an advisory panel to Secretary Rice on democracy promotion because of the work I did in that area. And I've been in meetings with her, and I'm very impressed by her. And I think she's tried in the last 4 years to move away from a unilateral foreign policy into a multilateral one where we actually listen to people and try to get their cooperation. She hasn't entirely succeeded, but she has other obstacles within the administration. But Gates and she wanted to close Guantanamo. And I said to this panel made up of a full spectrum of ideologues on left and right, I said, you know, not the rumors, but I hear from people right here in this department that both Gates and Rice want to close Guantanamo. Why don't we take up that issue? Let's look at the information they have on how to go about doing that and support them. And of course, the neocons in the room were angry with me, saying I was subverting the meaning of the meeting, of the advisory panel, which I then soon realized was only for show, to show that there was a bipartisan support for democracy promotion. So I haven't been to another meeting since.
For you. In the center here.
I have a question that's been bothering me a lot, because I'm from the South, and I've seen the hatred of people that have no tolerance for anyone of any other color but the whites. Are you concerned that Obama is going to be shot? And if so, is his security going to be heightened to prevent that?
His security has been heightened. I think every president since 9/11 has seen their security heightened. The Secret Service has not a difficult job, almost an impossible job, if someone is dedicated to giving up their life for that kind of a cause. I think that that every president is at risk, and we just have to hope and pray that that doesn't happen.
President-elect Obama has made so many commitments for so many initiatives that we're afraid that it's over-promising on too many fronts. Which three or four do you think he should actually focus on?
Let me make a general statement first, and that is, I think it was Mario Cuomo that said this, but you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. And already President Obama is looking at some facts that were not available to him, both with respect to the economy and national security. He's already said he probably will delay the reduction of the tax break for the richest Americans because of the recession that we're in. This isn't a time when you do things like that. And I think he's, I think, you know, if Americans have normative values and we have pragmatism. And this man seems to me to be a real American when it comes to being pragmatic. So the other aspect of the answer to your question, though, is stimulus. A lot of things need to get done in this country, including, as we know, infrastructure. Knowing it well from what's happened, a lot of our roads and bridges have really been allowed to fall apart. So if that's a way of creating more economic activity and creating jobs, then that's a good thing both in, to get the economy running again. The question will be, how much can you get done under the rubric of stimulus over the next year to get the economy running again? And then how do you turn it around and try to get more closely, move in the direction of a balanced budget? And he said he's actually assigned someone to look at government waste. And I have to say that if you look at the last four presidents in terms of their efforts at getting at government waste, that the Gore reinvention of government effort really produced a lot of reductions in government. And in fact, that administration ended up with a huge surplus, as opposed to the other three that I think of that always said that they were conservative about government waste, but ended up with huge deficits. So I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I think he's a pragmatist.
Brian, is there stuff that you worry about? You talked earlier about deals cut and so forth with other other countries. Is there stuff you worry about that can be going on between now and January 20th that we should keep our eye on?
Yeah, terrorism. I mean, I'm very worried after this Mumbai thing. I think that it's remarkable that the Indian Hindu people didn't go out after their Muslim citizens. That shows a sophistication of where this threat is coming from. I'm hopeful, and I think that there's a lot of diplomatic activity to this end going on right now, that people in India will recognize that the current Pakistani government is weak and that it's the best that India can hope for. It's a democratically elected government. It itself, the president of Pakistan's wife, Benazir Bhutto, was assassinated by a terrorist and a Pakistani terrorist. So there's a common objective to deal with terrorism. And I worry more about terrorism than anything else. There was just a report out the other day, Senator Graham, former Senator Robert Graham of Florida, and Senator Talent, co-led this delegate, this study group, basically saying that in the next 5 years, a terrorist attack, either biological or nuclear, is inevitable. And we've got to take steps there. When we're in a transition, there is a tendency of people to miscalculate us, to miscalculate and feel that we're vulnerable. And that's why I think it was so important for President-elect Obama to name his national security team so they could begin working right away with the current team, and why it's good that he kept on Secretary Gates.
So did you think Joe Biden opened his mouth and said something about this president will be
tested?
And
you know, he was just
made a big deal out of that. Sounds like
You can't tell the truth on the campaign trail.
Oh, right? That's the problem. I see.
You know, everybody analyzes every word, but the fact of the matter is, no matter who was elected president, whether it was McCain or Obama, there's going to be people out there that would want to test. You know, yeah.
You mentioned neocons a little while ago. How do you think those pesky neocons are going to fare in this transition?
They're going to go into academia. I don't think they're going to fare well. I hope they don't, because I think that their philosophy has been proven wrong.
Yes, is there a way that the United States can help in Sudan as we transition?
Yeah. We are very heavily involved in the southern part of Sudan with aid projects now, trying to create a country out of a place that has really very little infrastructure, no roads and the like, and trying to gain some understanding. The big issue in Sudan, obviously, is Darfur and the conduct there. Most of that activity, most of the horrible genocide that was going on has somewhat subsided, and people are... there are fewer deaths happening, but still you've got the big issue now is whether the International Tribunal will actually indict the sitting president of Sudan. And there is a very strong case that he used his influence to, in essence, an interesting charge is being levied against him, that he used rape as a method of genocide. And it's a serious, serious matter. And he, of course, is threatening everyone under the sun that he'll not allow activities to occur within his country if UN can't go in there with humanitarian efforts and the like if he is indicted. But I think, frankly, if the evidence is strong enough, he certainly should be. And it's going to be tricky. He is feeling that if there were truly a national election in Sudan, even people in the north would vote against his government and vote for a unified government. There's also the threat that the southern part of Sudan will secede in some way and become an independent nation. It will be one of the poorest nations on the earth. And, of course, there is oil in Sudan, which complicates all these matters because the Chinese are getting some of that oil, the Soviets are, and they still have vetoes on the Security Council, so it's difficult for the Security Council to take action. I don't know if that answers your question.
You talked about the cooperation or lack of cooperation between those coming in and those going out. Bush has said they'll be cooperating completely or as completely as possible. Do you have some insight on that? Is there as much cooperation as...
There is a very good cooperation. I'm very pleased. I think when you're in the midst of a financial crisis and you have a terrorism threat, it's a different ball game altogether. And I think that President Bush has been very gracious to the Obamas and that the State Department and, of course, the Defense Department has the easiest transition of all. But I think it's going really smoothly, and you have to give President Bush credit for this. The word has gone down that this is the way he wants it to be.
Question over here now.
Politics here. President Bush got elected by the Supreme Court for the first 4 years.
I see where you're coming from.
Yeah, okay. And then he, he said, you don't want it. You know, most people said, let's give him another chance. So they gave him another 4 years. But I'm thinking of the European system where they have a vote of no confidence and they can kind of boot these guys out if they're doing a terrible job. You think we need something like that in the United States?
I think we need a lot of reform in the United States. There's no question our systems need to be reformed. I don't like the Electoral College, at least the way it's set up now. If they would allow proportional proportional votes to occur within the context of the Electoral College, as the state of Maine does, for example, and one other state. In other words, the electors are actually have to vote on the basis of the proportion of the vote that actually took place. That puts every state in play, and that's important. I think our primary system needs to be changed, and we need to do regional primaries. I think our financing systems need to be changed. At the Humphrey Institute, our Center for the Study of Politics is looking at a lot of these issues, including redistricting here, and we will soon have a panel on recounts, just so people can understand that a little better. So Larry Jacobs does a great job for us there at the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance. However, moving to a parliamentary system for a large heterogeneous country like ours, with a tradition of states' rights and states, not sovereignty, but certainly independence of in many ways, the states themselves can decide to set up a unicameral legislature if they wish, as opposed to a bicameral one. I think that this idea that's come out of Minnesota for the transfer your vote to instant runoff voting. I think also is first of all, I believe it's democratic. I've had a briefing on it. I think it sounds like a good idea to bring the parties. You know, the concept of this system, which has been lost in the last several elections, is that when you get the two parties running, whether it's for the Senate or for the presidency, that the challenge of the two parties is to define the center from their own perspective. But it seems that the philosophy of the parties recently has been not certainly Obama's election, because he wanted to get as many votes as he could, but is to get to that 50.1%. And if this kind of a voting system ameliorates that problem, if the financing system can be changed to make it more equitable, that will help solve the problem. If people feel as though they have to campaign for the presidency in every state, that will help a lot. There needs to be many things to be done, but I think taking the step of going to a parliamentary system would contradict our history and our demography.
You mentioned Larry Jacobs. Is it okay to scoop here that Larry Jacobs is going to be doing a great conversation in the spring? Right? In the back here.
It seems to me that in this transition, that Russia is reasserting itself and taking advantage of the division or this transition time. And for example, talking about stationing rockets in Europe, and then the overtures to Cuba, and it's sort of throwing down the gauntlet to Obama at the time when the Bush administration can do it. What do we do about a situation like that, and how should we approach this?
Thank you. Good question. The first thing you do, it seems to me, there you are over there, first thing you do is recognize that Russia is a highly insecure country that used to think it was great, and it's not anymore, and that it's paranoid. Sometimes when you analyze, the motivations of people who make statements like their president Medvedev did, you have to just simply chalk it up to insecurity. Now, we have been somewhat a cause of that insecurity. I'm going to tell you that I was opposed to the Clinton administration's concept of enlarging NATO, because it seemed to me that at a time when Russia was weak, that this was encirclement, and that is exactly the way Russia sees it. If you look at it from their perspective, putting nuclear missile defense systems on their border and enlarging NATO to go into Ukraine and Georgia is very threatening to them. And as a country that is suffering, I mean, it's suffering more now than it was a year ago, because their oil prices are way down now. But they've managed with that extra oil revenue to beef up their military, not to be a threat to us, but to be a threat to neighbors like Georgia. You've got to understand where they're coming from if you're going to deal with them successfully. And Putin clearly is still the power behind the throne. He's a KGB guy. He thinks in old Cold War terms. We still have some people in this country that think that way too. But you gotta, you know what I would like to see happen with Russia is to sit down with them again on nuclear talks. If we're worried about nuclear weapons proliferating around the world, we should follow Max Kampelman's advice and Henry Kissinger's advice and George Shultz's advice. I mean, several people who've been secretaries of defense and state, Republicans and Democrats, who say we should work toward a non-nuclear world. And if we just work toward it, we can do a better job of dissuading countries from building nuclear weapons. And we have to have moral authority to do that. And we have to have an international legal regime if we're going to stop Iran and North Korea from building nuclear weapons. And we have to take the first steps ourselves. But if we get to the table with the Soviet Union, Russia, they will feel fulfilled. They're once again sitting at the table with the United States. What a big deal that is. We're the remaining superpower. So if you think about it in psychological terms, nations are much like people. And Russia right now is a very insecure person.
This may be a plug for your program, but every once in a while I'll hear on NPR that the Humphrey Institute has a panel or a speaker that comes in. How available are those to the outside public?
Well, we're trying hard to compete with the College of Continuing Education. They're very open to the public. That's what we have a 250-seat auditorium. We've just redone it to make it put television cameras and lights in there so that we can go beyond that auditorium so that you can look at our programs on the Internet as well. So we would love to have the list of people that are here tonight, but I thought that's probably not fair to Dean Nichols. There you go.
I appreciate what you were just saying before. Do presidents consult at all with psychologists or social scientists? It seems like you don't hear if they do. And as you're pointing out, a lot of this boils down to understanding another leader's psychology as well as a country's culture and psychology, and it would be very valuable if they would, if they don't. Do you know anything about that?
The CIA does psychological profiles on foreign leaders. They really do. They do. I don't believe that they're allowed to do a psychological profile on the president. We leave that to the first lady.
Right here. Limitations in food and energy, or at least distribution inequities, certainly are a real issue on the international stage. But where does population explosion or control come into play, and what, if anything, has the State Department talk about population?
Well, one of AID's bigger programs, and they've been an international leader, is in family planning, making available to people the wherewithal, whether it's natural or using contraceptives, to plan the size of their family in accordance with their own resources and ability to take care of that family. And there have been major strides in this regard. In fact, they've revised down the projection of population increases by the year 2050, where most people think it will stabilize. And so it isn't as big a crisis. Now, in the 1970s, you recall Paul Ehrlich wrote a book about the saying, in essence, that we would have to go through a triage situation where we'd just have to let people die. And that inspired people like Norman Borlaug from here to get involved in the Green Revolution. And now there is a major food crisis in the world right now. And it's mainly the price of food that has gone up by 50%. And if you're a family that makes if the poverty level for the world is about $730, $2 a day, $760, whatever that number. That's not a lot of money, and if your price of food has gone up by 50%, I mean, all of us know what the impact on our household was when the price of gas was up at $4. You can imagine food. We can do without gas, not many of us who live here, but you can't do without food. So there are all sorts of questions that are being asked about why, and of course, ethanol and using corn, a food substance instead of something that might be less take less out of the food markets of the world. A lot of analysis is being done, but it's an irony that we're at a stage now that because of the financial crisis, the number of people living in poverty has gone way up, and the price of food has gone way up, and we're saying, well, we really can't afford to give more for foreign aid, and yet if we don't, we're going to see more instability in the world, more crime, more terrorism, more all of the bad things that cost us money. We have a $600 billion plus defense budget because of that instability. So either you pay now and you prevent it, or you pay later and you have to pay more. It's my philosophy. It's not a
Brian,
philosophy.
Brian, will you take one last question here in the center?
When we hear about Iraq, we don't hear a lot about the Kurds. What's the likelihood that they're going to break away after we pull out of Iraq?
The Kurds, you do hear something about their conflict with the people that Saddam moved into that city in the north, and I can't now recall the name of it. A lot of their homes were taken, and there will be conflict if that isn't resolved. You don't hear a lot about the Kurds, I think primarily because, first of all, the president of Iraq is a Kurd, although the president, is it the vice president of Iraq, I guess, is a Kurd. But you also have the Turks there on the border who have actually attacked inside because of people who are using terrorist tactics to attack Turkey across the border and inside Turkey as well. So they're not talking a lot about independence, but you can't scratch too far below the surface to find that a Kurd that doesn't want independence. I mean, they all want independence. And eventually we'll have to address that issue. But right now, they can't really break away without breaking away from all of the potential Iraq oil resources that will benefit them as well. I don't think that we can force an answer that says, let's break Iraq into three pieces. We've got to hope that they can find a way to work together. And I think that without having us as a target, when they get to the point where they're forced to reconcile their differences or else they're going to fall into civil war, one has to hope that they will address those issues, and they will give a good deal of autonomy. And of course, the Kurds are looking for as much autonomy as they can get because eventually they want to use that as a platform for independence.
Well, Brian, I feel so enlightened, and I bet the audience does too, by your professor's insights and your many personal stories. We want to thank you so much for all you shared with us.
Thank you.